This is Skeptic Sunday. I guess one could be skeptical about a variety of things. You could be skeptical, for example, about global warming or about the claims of politicians, whether Democratic or Republican, or about your brother-in-law's claim to have climbed the Matterhorn last summer. You can be skeptical about a wide variety of things, but I take it the skepticism involved here has to do with religion, skepticism about Christian belief or maybe about belief in God more generally. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say I am not such a skeptic. So if you wanted to hear an advocacy of skepticism, you come to the wrong place. I want to talk about certain reasons that some people propose for being skeptical about religious belief, about belief in God, for example, or about more narrowly, belief in Christian, in the whole Christian faith. And the particular ones I want to talk about are skeptical suggestions or skeptical claims from science. That's not the right way to put it. I should put it like this. Some people claim that there are some important parts of science that are incompatible with various parts of Christian belief. And I want to address a couple of those suggestions. Among the places where people claim there is such an inconsistency or incompatibility would be, for example, certain forms of contemporary scientific scripture scholarship, like historical biblical criticism, some varieties of that, some theories from evolutionary psychology, which is probably by now has become, or at any rate is on the edge of becoming, orthodoxy in psychology departments. Also, something people sometimes refer to as the scientific worldview. Hard to know exactly what its relationship to science is, but people think it's intimately connected with science and it has no room in it for God or other parts of Christian belief. Also, evolution, as everybody knows, a really hot button type kind of issue. And also, say, divine action in the world, God's special action in the world, miracles, for example. Many people claim that this is somehow incompatible with science, and maybe still other places too. I want to talk about two of these places, two of these flashpoints, you might say, about evolution on the one hand and divine action in the world on the other hand, those two things, all right? And I'll start with divine action in the world. And I hope everybody has a handout like this, all right? Unlike the Harsmas who were here last time and the time before, I don't do PowerPoint or anything else high-tech. When it comes to things high-tech, I have to ask my grandchildren. So that's a bit beyond me. On the other hand, I think there's a lot to be said for the humble handout. For example, you can write on it, and you can refer back and forth. If you're at the end of it, you can go back to the beginning and take a look at it. You can take it home. It can be a record of wherever it was that you got the handout, whatever went on. You can use it in the last analysis to start a fire in your fireplace. So there's a lot to be said for the humble handout. So then first, divine action in the world. The classical Christian idea is that God has created our world and has created it in such a way that there's an enormous amount of dependability or regularity in it, more than one ordinarily thinks. Everything that we do really depends on such regularities and dependability. If it weren't for this kind of regularity or dependability, we really couldn't act at all. Well, there's very little we could do. I mean, for example, if when you are building a house, you wanted to build a house, you want to pound a nail into some wood, if the nail would turn into an earthworm, let's say, that would really be disconcerting, or if the nail would just disappear or turn into a small giraffe. I mean, of course, these things don't happen, but the reason they don't happen is because of this regularity and dependability that God has built into our world, so Christians think. If you want to go for a walk, you depend on, for example, friction. You depend on the force of gravity being relatively constant. It would be terrible, you know, if the force of gravity suddenly quadrupled as you're walking along. You crump, you come down like that. Or if it suddenly was reduced by 90% and you take a step and you shoot way off into the sky, again, this would be, you know, very worrying. You wouldn't like that. And I wouldn't like that either. So there is this regularity and dependability in the world. And the Christian idea of God's, the way God treats the world is he has created it, and he created it in such a way that there is this regularity and dependability. But also, according to Scripture, there are various times when God does something special, some kind of special action. Miracles, for example, the parting of the Red Sea, and in the New Testament, Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, and above all, Jesus turning water into wine, above all, Jesus himself rising from the dead. But not just in Bible times. Many Christians, classical Christians, think now that God does things like this. God responds to prayers. There are miraculous healings. God works in the hearts and minds of his children. There is what John Calvin calls the internal testimony of the Holy Spirit, whereby God gets us to see the truth of the great things of the gospel. This is promised by Jesus. St. Paul writes about it. These are all cases of God's acting in the world. So God constantly causes things to happen in the world. Well, okay, fair enough. What's the problem? Many theologians think there is a science-religion problem here. So, for example, I say a science-religion problem. So, for example, Rudolf Bultmann says, if you look on the sheet there, the historical method, which he advocates, includes the presupposition that history is a unity, that history is a unity in the sense of a closed continuum of effects in which individual events are connected by the succession of cause and effect. So the idea is history is an enormous stretch tapestry of facts or events, and these events are related by a cause and effect, all right? And then he goes on to say, this continuum, furthermore, cannot be rent by the interference of supernatural, transcendental, or transcendent powers. Not even by God, he's saying. Maybe God has created the world, Bultmann thinks, but once he's created it, he can't interfere in it. Notice the word interfere. I mean, that's a pejorative term, right? If you say somebody's interfering, you're suggesting they're doing something that they should be ashamed of themselves for doing, right? His idea seems to be, well, if God interfered, if God did something in the world, this would be interfering and he should be ashamed of himself. His idea here reminds me a little bit of the laws of the Medes and Persians. In the book of Daniel, as you remember, Daniel is a favorite of King Darius. He's a courtier in the king's court. But the other courtiers become jealous of Daniel because the king likes him best. And they want to bring Daniel down somehow. So they come to the king and they say, O king, live forever. You always have to address a king that way. If you ever run into one, that's the way you do it. O king, live forever. We think it would be a great idea if you would pass an edict to the effect that no one can worship anybody but you. Well, the king thought that over for a minute, and he said, yeah, that's a good idea. So he passed this edict. He announced, nobody may worship anybody but me, King Darius. Well, then these courtiers were watching Daniel, and of course Daniel didn't pay all that much attention. He went right ahead and worshiped the Lord anyway. And the penalty here for worshiping anybody but Darius was to be thrown into the lion's den. So then the courtiers came to King Darius, and they said, O king, live forever. This miserable Daniel, you know what he does? He worships somebody besides you. So he's got to be thrown into the lion's den. Well, then the king was not happy with that because he really liked Daniel. He definitely did not want to throw him into the lion's den. But then the courtiers said, O king, live forever. And they said that a lot. O king, live forever. You remember the laws of the Medes and Persians. Once one of them has been enacted by the sovereign, it cannot be abrogated by anybody, not even by the king himself. So they had to throw Daniel into the lion's den. Well, Boltzmann's idea about the laws of about nature, the laws of nature, this closed continuum that he talks about, is a little bit like that. It's like he says maybe God could has in fact created things, created the world, created the laws according to which the world proceeds. But once he's done that, he can't interfere at all. And that's what he's saying here. Another person who says something similar, well, of course, and the point here is he says this continuum cannot be rent by the interference of supernatural transcendent powers. Not even God can do anything about that. Not even God can act in this continuum. Another person says the same sort of thing. Langdon Gilkey says, the causal nexus in space and time, which the Enlightenment science and philosophy introduced into the Western mind, is also assumed by modern theologians and scholars. Since they participate in the modern world of science, both intellectually and existentially, they can scarcely do anything else. They can't help themselves. Now, this assumption of a causal order among phenomenal events, and this is the same then as the as that closed continuum of effects that Boltzmann talks about, this assumption of a causal order among phenomenal events, and therefore of the authority of the scientific interpretation of observable events, makes a great difference to the validity one assigns to biblical narratives, and so to the way one understands their meaning. Suddenly, a vast panoply of divine deeds and events recorded in Scripture are no longer regarded as having actually happened. Okay, so here's the same idea then. There is this closed continuum, this causal nexus that Gilkey calls it, closed continuum that Boltzmann calls it, and God cannot act, cannot do anything in that causal nexus. So what exactly is the problem? Well, their problem is with special divine action. I mean, they're prepared to agree that God could has created the world, that God upholds it, conserves it in being, so that without his conserving activity, the world would disappear like a candle flame in a high wind. But when it comes to something beyond that, miracles, for example, that's what they object to. And they think the reason they object to this is there is some kind of contrariety to science. Gilkey says this would be contrary to science to suppose that God would act in the world in a way that goes beyond creation and conservation. Okay? And it's not only theologians, like these liberal theologians, that say this. Many philosophers do. So on the sheet there, Philip Clayton, who's a professor of philosophy at one of the schools in Claremont, he says, many, both inside and outside of theology, have abandoned any doctrine of divine action as incompatible with the natural sciences. It's not only philosophers and theologians that say this, though. Also many scientists do. Richard Dawkins, whom I'm going to be talking about a bit in just a bit, and Peter Atkins, I must say I think of them as sort of on the lunatic fringe, but also many scientists who clearly are not on the lunatic fringe would agree with Clayton and Gilkey and Boltzmann. So, for example, H. Allen Orr, a very sensible scientist. He's a biologist at Rochester University. He often writes in the New York Review of Books. He wrote a review of a book by Richard Dawkins. The book by Dawkins was called The Devil's Chaplain. And in this book, Dawkins says a lot of very uncomplimentary things about religion, that people who believe, who are religious are, he calls them faith heads, and he says they are irrational, and we've got to figure out, you know, we need some special explanation as to why people who get along fairly well in the world otherwise would hold such irrational views. In any event, when H. Allen Orr reviewed this book, he said in the New York Review of Books that Dawkins didn't really understand religion at all, and he was much too hard on it, and he should talk about something else. Well, then another scientist wrote in the letters to the editor and said, one problem, of course, with religions that makes it look like Dawkins is right is that so many of them endorse miracles. And then H. Allen Orr said in response, replying to this letter to the editor, he says, "Oh, right. It's not that some sects of one religion invoke miracles, but that many sects of many religions do. Moses, after all, parted the waters, and Krishna healed the sick." "I agree, of course," says H. Allen Orr, that no sensible scientist can tolerate such exceptionalism with respect to the laws of nature. All right? No sensible scientist can tolerate such exceptionalism, can tolerate the existence of miracles. Of course, if miracles do happen, if God does actually do miracles sometimes, it's not going to matter a whole lot whether scientists, sensible or otherwise, tolerate them. I mean, it's not really up to them, right? It's not like they say, well, this is intolerable, and so it can't happen. This reminds me a little bit of an American woman philosopher, Margaret Fuller, who was a transcendentalist philosopher, a friend of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who once announced, "I accept the universe." Whereupon Mark Twain said, "Good grief, I didn't know it had been offered to her." I mean, the universe is, that's not up to us to accept it or not. I mean, that's not within our purview, nor is it up within anybody's purview to fail to tolerate miracles. Of course, you can fail to tolerate it, if you like. I mean, like I might fail to tolerate the sun's rising tomorrow, but it's not going to make any difference. So the real problem here that these people see is that science promulgates natural laws, Newton's laws, for example. And if God did miracles or acted specially in the world, he would have to contravene these laws. He would have to intervene in this closed continuum that Boltzmann mentions. And that's contrary to science. Okay. Now my question is this really true? These people are thinking in terms of what we could call the old picture of science, the old picture. They're thinking in terms of classical science, which would be Newtonian mechanics and maybe the science of electricity and magnetism, Maxwell's equations. They're thinking of science along those lines. They're thinking substantially of classical or Newtonian science. And of course, Newton did have an astonishing influence in the modern world, in history up to maybe some 100 years ago or 50 or maybe even later than that. Alexander Pope wrote an epitaph for Newton that said, went something like this, "Nature and her laws were hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light." So he had a very high opinion of Newton. And so do these people like Boltzmann and so on. Now, we can speak, if we want to, about the Newtonian world picture, which is a picture of the world as something like an enormous machine, a giant machine, proceeding according to the laws of classical physics, according to these fixed laws. But that's not enough for being an anti-interventionist or a hands-off theology type, as these people that I mentioned previously were, because Newton himself, one certainly hopes anyway, it would be scandalous if this weren't true, Newton himself accepted the Newtonian world picture, but he didn't accept hands-off theology. He didn't think God has to keep his hands off this causal nexus that Gilkey talks about, because he thought that if God didn't periodically adjust the orbits of the planets, these orbits would spiral off into incoherence. So he thought every now and then God had to, you know, tweak things just a bit. And he thought God acted in the world in many other ways besides that. Newton's laws, as Newton thought of them, describe the world, how the world works, provided that or when the world is a closed, isolated system, subject to no outside causal influence. So the laws of Newtonian mechanics, as Newton thought of them, should be thought of as describing the world provided that God isn't doing something special in the world, provided that the system in question is closed or closed to outside causal influence, isolated from outside causal influence. And the great conservation laws that are deduced from Newton's laws are stated for closed or isolated systems. So in Sears and Szymanski's University Physics, which is a widely used physics textbook, this is what they say. This is the principle of conservation of linear momentum. When no resultant external force acts on a system, the total momentum of the system remains constant in magnitude and direction. And the principle of conservation of energy states that the internal energy of an isolated system remains constant. This is the most general statement of the principle of conservation of energy. So the point here is these laws apply to closed systems, systems closed to any outside causal influence or causal activity. But if that's true, then there's nothing in these laws to prevent God from changing the velocity or direction of a particle, or as far as that goes, from creating out of nothing a full-grown horse right here. God could say, let there be a horse right there. And such a horse would pop into existence. And this would in no way be incompatible with Newtonian mechanics or classical science. Because any system in which God did such a thing would not be an isolated or a closed system, obviously, right? It would not be closed to outside causal influence. But the laws are stated for closed systems, so they don't really apply to ones in which there is outside causal activity, as there would be if God created such a horse right here. All right? And furthermore, it's no part of Newtonian mechanics or classical science generally to declare that the material universe is a closed system. Many people say that it is, but it's not part of science as such. It's more like a metaphysical or theological add-on. Okay, that's the old picture. The new picture, science since roughly speaking 100 years ago or maybe 90 years ago, science since then has undergone a really substantial revolution. And there's even less reason to think that current science, say quantum mechanics, there's even less reason to think that quantum mechanics is somehow inconsistent with divine special action than there is to think that classical mechanics is. I won't go into that now because I don't have enough time, but if anybody wants to talk about it during the discussion period, that's fine with me. Okay. Now, next, there's a second section involves the so-called new atheists. Earlier on, Jack spoke of the death of God theologians of many years ago. They have thankfully and quite properly retreated into the woodwork. But what has emerged from the woodwork is probably something worse, namely the current new so-called new atheists, the four horsemen of atheism. Not the four horsemen of the apocalypse, not even the four horsemen of Notre Dame. These would be much easier to put up with. But the four horsemen of atheism, and their intent is to trample belief in God and religion generally into the ground, all right? These four horsemen would be Daniel Dennett, his book Darwin's Dangerous Idea and Breaking the Spell, Christopher Hitchens, his book God is Not Great, Sam Harris, The End of Faith, and Richard Dawkins, and one of his most recent books is The God Delusion. I'm not going to say much about these except just to point to their existence. But they all declare that there is this irresolvable conflict between science and religion. Take a look at that quotation from Dawkins, The God Delusion. He says, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all of fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully. He's not totally pleased with God. These new atheists have sort of sprung into view, and their books are bestsellers. They are quite different from the old atheists, for example, Bertrand Russell and John Mackey and C.D. Broad and others. The new atheists are vastly noisier, I would say to the point of hysterical screaming, than the old atheists. The old atheists, I would say, are much more cogent. Dawkins, for example, says, "Anyone who doesn't believe in evolution is stupid, ignorant, insane, or wicked," says Dawkins. And Daniel Dennett goes Dawkins one or two or possibly three better. He says, "Anyone who has doubts about evolution is culpably ignorant." So if you have doubts about evolution, you don't necessarily disbelieve it, but you have doubts about it, then you are two of the things Dawkins says you might be one of, namely culpable or wicked and ignorant. Dawkins gives you a choice. You could be ignorant, or you could be stupid, or you could be insane, or you could be wicked. But Dennett is made of sterner stuff. He says you are two of these things automatically. If you so much as doubt evolution, you wake up in the middle of the night, think about this whole theory, this vast theory which covers so much ground and so on, a small doubt creeps into your mind, bam, you are culpably ignorant, says says Dennett. All right? And Dawkins also says we should treat faith heads, which is his term for people who believe in God. He says we should treat them with naked contempt. He says we should treat them. Of course, if he were talking to us, you know, and the "we" included all of us, I don't know, that might not go so well. But that's what he says. They should be treated with naked contempt. And Daniel Dennett, apparently these people also have their own heroes of the faith. So Daniel Dennett, for example, says, because he attacks religion, he says, "I risk a fist to the face or worse, yet I persist. I am really, you know, tough. Even though I risk a fist to the face, I keep on saying these things." Of course, to attack religion in the contemporary academy is about as dangerous as endorsing the Republican nominee at the Republican National Convention. You don't risk a fist to the face at all. Well, I'm not going to talk here about this next little argument on the part of Dawkins, because I want to save some time here for discussion. And I want to turn instead now to the second of these areas I wanted to talk about. The first was divine action in the world, and I wanted to say I don't think there is any conflict at all, even between classical science and divine action in the world, and certainly not between contemporary science. I want to talk now a bit about evolution. According to G.G. Simpson, for example, who is an outstanding evolutionary scientist of the last century, he said, "Man," and I would add parenthetically, no doubt woman as well, "is the result of a purposeless natural process that did not have him in mind." I imagine, he says just man, but I imagine he means to include woman. It would be an interesting thing to think about, an interesting view, to think that man was a process of a purposeless process that didn't have him in mind, but not so for women. But I don't want to discuss that. That sounds like one could get into trouble there. So anyway, that's what he says. Richard Dawkins in The Blind Watchmaker puts it like this. He says, "All appearances to the contrary, the only watchmaker in nature is the blind forces of physics, albeit deployed in a very special way. A true watchmaker has foresight. He designs his cogs and springs and plans their interconnections with a future purpose in his mind's eye. Natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process which Darwin discovered and which we now know is the explanation for the existence and purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind and no mind's eye. It does not plan for the future. It has no vision, no foresight, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is the blind watchmaker. And then the subtitle of his book is Why the Evidence of Evolution Reveals a Universe Without Design. So his claim is that evolution, the theory of evolution just as such, is incompatible with the thought that the universe has been designed. But, of course, any believer in God has to think of the universe as having been designed. Any believer in God thinks that God has created our world and therefore also has designed it. So his claim is that the evidence of evolution reveals a universe without design, and hence reveals that there really isn't any such person as God at all. All right? In his book, he does three things. First, he recounts some of the fascinating anatomical details of certain living creatures and their ways. He talks about bats, for example, and how bats can fly, navigate at a very high rate of speed through a completely dark cave, avoiding all the stalagmites that hang down from the top and the stalactites that stick up from the bottom, or maybe it's the other way around, doesn't matter. Anyway, the stalags, avoiding all of these because they've got this sonar device whereby, you know, they emit high-pitched sounds that bounce off any obstacle in the way and inform the bat of just where this thing is, and the bats can fly accordingly. He also tries to refute arguments for the conclusion that blind, unguided evolution could not have produced certain of the wonders of the living world. So, for example, going all the way back to Darwin's time, there were people, St. George Mivart, for example, who said, as far as they could see, blind, unguided evolution could not produce certain things. For example, the eye was one favorite example. That was also an example of St. George Mivart himself. The eye contains all of these magnificent processes that are parts that are adjusted to each other in a very fantastically finely tuned sort of fashion. And it's hard to see how you could, I mean, if you make a change in one little part, which might be a change on the way to a better eye, it might not work with the contemporary eye, with what you've got now at all. And so it's really hard to see how this, how coming up from below, so to speak, you could wind up by means of a blind process like evolution, wind up with such a thing as the eye, something so highly integrated and with such an enormous amount of so many parts having to be so minutely adjusted to each other. All right? Dawkins tries to show that these arguments don't work. And then finally, he makes suggestions as to how these and other organic systems could have developed by unguided evolution. The form of his main argument, though, I mean, the main argument is for the claim that the evidence of evolution reveals a universe without design. The form of the main argument, as far as I can see, in the book goes like this. We know of no irrefutable objections to its being biologically possible that all of life has come to be by way of unguided Darwinian processes. So the idea, so the thought is, we could put it like this. Nobody has proved it's impossible that all of life should have come to be by virtue of unguided Darwinian processes. Nobody has proved that impossible. Therefore, all of life has come to be by way of unguided Darwinian processes. Okay? Think about that for a moment. The premise says substantially, nobody has proved this is impossible, from which he infers, therefore, it's true. I mean, imagine I come home and tell my wife, Kathleen, you know what? President Obama has just decided that there should be a medal for philosophy, and I am to be the first recipient. And she says, well, that's wonderful. How do you know that? And I say, nobody's proved it impossible. That's, you can imagine, you know, how that would be greeted in my house or your house. Not with enthusiasm, all right? So I would say Dawkins utterly fails to show that the facts of evolution reveal a universe without design. Still, the fact that he and others assert his subtitle loudly and slowly, as it were, the way you talk to an inattentive 10-year-old, for example, you know, he's thinking about something else altogether. You repeat this loudly and slowly, all right? This can be expected to convince many that the biological theory of evolution is, in fact, incompatible with the theistic belief that the living world has been designed. Okay. Now I'm going to skip down to where it says, why do so many Christians reject evolution? So why do so many Christians reject evolution? Is it sheer anti-science, anti-intellectualism? Is that why? In the Tuesday New York Times, there was an op-ed entitled, "The Evangelical Rejection of Reason." The Evangelical Rejection of Reason. And a prime exhibit of the evangelical rejection of reason is that many evangelicals reject evolution. I think fewer than half of evangelicals believe in evolution. I mean, I saw some different figures. According to one of these figures, only 4% of evangelicals believed in evolution. According to the other one, something like 30% did. I have no idea what the right percentage is, but certainly it's very likely less than a half. Okay, but now this is a question. Is it sheer anti-science, anti-intellectualism that leads evangelicals to reject religion? I mean, sorry, that would not work. That leads evangelicals to reject evolution? Well, not necessarily. I mean, if the experts, Dawkins and Dennett and Peter Atkins and very many others, some of the others I mentioned, Stephen Gould, if they all insist that the contemporary theory of evolution is incompatible with the world's having been designed by God or anyone else, if they all insisted, it's not surprising that lots of evangelicals and others would believe them. They are, after all, the experts, and that's what they say about the theory. And if you think that theory really is of that sort, incompatible with the idea that the world has been designed, well, if you're an evangelical, you've then got your choice. You can either believe that or you can believe in God, but you can't believe in both, right? So if you reject evolution, I would say, under those conditions, I would say that's not a matter of anti-science or anti-intellectualism. It's just simple logic, right? So in a way, I say these people are wrong. I say the theory of evolution, the scientific theory of evolution, doesn't say anything one way or the other about whether evolution is a guided process. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, as far as the scientific theory goes. The theory doesn't say anything about it one way or the other. Dennett and Dawkins and his friends add their naturalism, their rejection of God. They add their naturalism to the theory and then deduce from the theory that it's incompatible with divine design. Well, of course, if you add that to it, that conjunction will be incompatible with divine design. I mean, if you add naturalism to, say, the phone book, the result will be incompatible with divine design. But it's not part of the theory as such, so I say, and so lots of other people say too. But on the other hand, many of these eminent experts say it is, and then it's not surprising that if they say it is, people believe that, and if they believe that, if they're evangelicals, reject the theory of evolution. Well, I think I will stop at that point. The next little step here would be this. So I say evolution is compatible with mere Christianity, where mere Christianity is what you might call something like the intersection of the great Christian creeds, the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed, the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism, the Luther's Catechism, the Westminster Confession, and the like. I think if you take what they all have in common, that's entirely compatible with current evolutionary theory. So evolution may be compatible with mere Christianity, but, you know, what about sort of fuller or more highly developed versions of Christianity, for example, what you find in the Belgic Confession and the Heidelberg Catechism? Well, I'll leave that question for discussion, and I will stop at this point.